Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today, in our second discussion about geopolitics, we're going to focus a bit more clearly on Halford Mackinder and on what one might call the liberal unionist moment in British history, in the sense that the liberal unionists, and just to remind people, the Liberal Party, the governing party under Gladstone, split over the issue of Home Rule for Ireland, with the majority, the Liberal Party, very much pushed by Gladstone in favour of this. They saw it as a way to sort of keep Irish opinion on board, whilst a significant minority of the Liberal Party thought that Home Rule for Ireland would be a step that would take Ireland towards eventual independence, and on top of that, would weaken the empire, both specifically with reference to Ireland, but more generally as a principle. And those weren't the only reasons. There were other issues. The Liberal Unionists were unhappy with what they saw as a radical direction, a leftward direction, we might wish to say, in Gladstonian politics. But the net effect was a division within the Liberal Party, a significant group of Liberals becoming Liberal Unionists and campaigning against the Liberals, and increasingly aligning with, as they eventually did, the Conservatives. And this is an important moment in British history, because what one sees is a position of flux in terms of party. Of course, flux is also seen with the rise of Labour in those years, which is a separate trajectory. And one sees a flux in terms of debate and discussion about Britain's position in the world, political position, economic position, and military position. And in a way, Mackinder and the interest that is shown in him reflects that position of flux. It's, as we've already made clear, there is a separate genesis of the of geopolitical ideas, specific and explicit geopolitical ideas, in the case of Sweden and Germany, and we've already discussed that with Ratzel and Lebensraum, and looking towards a later German, if one likes to use the term, race-spatial politics. That's not the case with Mackinder. Mackinder is more to do with a debate about the nature of empire, the direction of empire, and in particular, a sense of gloom. I've already mentioned that Mackinder had this idea that what he called the Columbian Age, a reference to Christopher Columbus, and in particular to the idea of maritime power, the idea that the Columbian Age was coming to a close as a result of the emphasis now on transcontinental railways. And also, of course, famously in this period, Joseph Chamberlain gives his weary Titan speech about how British industries are being crippled by the country sticking to free trade, whilst protectionist rivals are doing well. And there was also concern in many circles, often for different targets, about a sense of social decline, whether that social decline was due to the demon drink, whether it was due to socialism, whether it was due to the working class and women allegedly not knowing their place, whether it was due to urban life being bad for people's health, both moral health and physical health, and also to contributing towards irreligion. One could go on and on and on. But all of those contributed to a sense that there was something wrong in British society, And I think one can consider an assessment, a reassessment of geopolitics in that period as part of that. Because in a sense, when Britain had been the great power, shall we say, immediately after the Napoleonic Wars, and indeed, I think it's fair to say that until France and Russia align in the 1880s, 1890s, there was on the whole, a reasonable confidence. There might be particular anxieties about France with the ironclad race at the end of the 1850s, beginning of the 1860s. There might be worry about Russia on the supposed route to India in the mid-1850s, the late 1870s, the mid-1880s. But these tended to be individual crises. The sense of a collective crisis, a broader crisis, becomes more significant at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And this, as it were, forces people to give up what, to use modern vocabulary, one might call a holiday from history. In other words, to realize and accept that the situation was more dire than had been anticipated, and that this might well involve the need for new priorities, new ideas, new solutions. Now, solutions could go in different directions. As we know, in 1914, the solution was to intervene with the army in a European war, which was to be extraordinarily costly for Britain. That was a solution, intervention in European power politics. Another solution was the idea of a stronger dominion process of cooperation. Another idea, not incompatible with that, was a notion which was strong at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, of a kind of Anglosphere, a sort of idea which had a degree of ethnicity in the argument of sort of Anglo-Saxon values, etc., that was pushed to the fore by some commentators, both British and American. So what we need to do is to understand that there is a dynamic background to discussion of what we might call geopolitical ideas in this period. And we need to accept that there was no one way to apply them, even if you argued for the significance of understanding geography. And there were writers of the period, such as the Oxford geographer Hereford George, who were writing about the relationship between geography and history, and with a degree more profundity than most of the trite stuff that comes out today. But even if you were going to argue that, it didn't mean that it was obviously the case that there was a particular course to pursue. And indeed, if you read Mackinder carefully, you can detect that at times he offers what appears to be, in his mind, a clear solution, but at other times he's a little bit more opaque in that fashion. And this is not surprising. I mean, just as an interlude, I picked up, it came through the post this afternoon, which is a rare experience, the post to arrive. For foreign listeners, the post is something that comes once a decade now, more regularly than a more irregularly than a general direct election. Anyway, this brought two worthies writing about, what a surprise, Halford Mackinder's theory of containment and the conflict in Ukraine, in which they read easily from one to the other in what they call Mackinderite analysis, and they offer an easy summary of the former and its application, a ready application to Ukraine. Well, we're going to try and follow a similar course towards the end, but let listeners be aware there is no simple application, there is no facile prioritization, and most people who have got any sense who've written about geopolitics have done so within a permissive rather than a prescriptive context, an envelope. So, from that background, I'm not implying that there was only one liberal unionist way to look at geopolitics. and I want to be quite cautious about suggesting otherwise. Anyway, in the case of Mackinder, as I think I've already mentioned, he was not simply an academic, which he was, and a successful one, indeed becoming director of the London School of Economics from 1903 to 1908. And that was at a time when the LSE was seen as part of the answer in terms of a kind of modern brains trust, German model form of applied higher education, rather than what was seen often fairly, sometimes unfairly, of a kind of amateur, of the contrast of an amateurism of Oxbridge. Anyway, Mackinder had also been an unsuccessful parliamentary candidate in 1900. He was to be again in 1909. He was to be an MP from 1910 to 1922. His subsequent posts included High Commissioner to South Russia in 1919 to 20, at a time of British intervention, Chairman of the Imperial Shipping Committee in 1920 to 45, and Chairman of the Imperial Economic Committee in 1925 to 31. Mackinder himself moved to join the Conservatives in 1903, but prior to that was one of their allied liberal unionists. And indeed, I would argue that his politics can be seen in terms of liberal unionism and the way that gets integrated into the Conservative mainstream. And indeed, it's interesting here that the Conservatives had, the Tories, their progenitors, had often been very cautious about many aspects of imperial expansion, concerned about the cost, etc., etc. Well, liberal unionism is a much more determined exponent of that kind of activity. And I think that's worth noting, because it's all too easy to forget that element of it. Now, Mackinder himself, as I've already mentioned, in his 1904 address, argued in favour of essentially an analysis of the world. It was very much a global account of power politics. It didn't necessarily and specifically mean that the British had to go in a particular direction, but what it did do was to suggest that the situation indeed was becoming more dire for them. Now, a reasonable question, indeed one that Graham asked me in an email not so long ago, was, well, what influence did this have on British power politics of that period? And I think it's fair to say that, and this, unfortunately, it's a case that many of the people that have written on Mackinder haven't really given adequate thought to this, that it's not as though it did determine matters. I mean, one of the things that's worth bearing in mind is Mackinder was trying to offer a general viewpoint. I mean, at the end of his 1904 lecture, he declared, "I have spoken as a geographer. The actual balance of political power at any given time is, of course, the product on the one hand of geographical conditions, both economic and strategic, and on the other hand of the relative number, virility, equipment, and organization of the competing powers." Now, the virility, of course, reflects the idea of organic theories of government. But I think the point that's worth bearing in mind is that Mackinder's argument in no way demonstrated the need or requirement for Britain either to have an entente with France, as indeed happened swiftly afterwards that year, or not to have an entente with France. You could argue that Mackinder was providing a warning about the heartland power and about, therefore, the need for everybody on the periphery to cooperate against the heartland power. He argued that impregnable to attack by sea, the heartland, Russia essentially, could not be attacked by the leading naval power, Britain, and later, obviously, would be the United States. He argued that the heartland of Eurasia constituted, quote, the pivot region of the world's politics, and saw, quote, Europe and European history subordinate to Asia and Asiatic history. For European civilization, quote, is the outcome of the secular struggle against Asiatic invasions. For 1,000 years, a series of horse-riding peoples emerged from Asia. Well, that's all very well, but what does it mean in practice? Does it mean that we should ally with France in order to deter Russia because France is a pivot power, is a peripheral power? Well, we do ally with France in 1904, but of course, France is actually an ally, a closer ally of Russia. So possibly not. Does it mean that we should instead ally with Germany, try and make sure that Germany does not look to Russia, doesn't revive the Dreikaiserbund, the Three Emperors League, which had seen Germany, Austria, and Russia all allies, and that instead Britain should reach out to Germany and urge Germany to, as it were, unite against Mackinder's vision of these horse-riding nomads? Well, no, it doesn't. And if he did think that, he certainly doesn't bring it out in any clear fashion. And what link is there between what Mackinder says and the fact that in 1907 we have an entente with Russia and an attempt to settle outstanding Anglo-Russian international rivalries and tensions, most specifically by agreeing on spheres of influence in Persia, modern-day Iran? Is that Mackinderite or is it not? Is, in fact, the term Mackinderite particularly helpful in this context? And the answer, you will not be surprised to hear, is that British politicians and statesmen and officials were not sitting there waiting for views of academics to opine and provide an answer. And indeed, it is worth noting that studies of the attempt to produce formal influences on British policymaking, particularly in international relations, in the 20th century, in academic contexts, have not been terribly helpful. The Foreign Office, for example, was party to an attempt to study the Abadan crisis of 1951. It didn't do much good. I don't think anybody is going to seriously suggest that the lengthy government report on the Falklands Island crisis, Falkland Island War, I should say, sorry, actually produced something that was tremendously useful, etc., etc. And indeed, one of the great risks of us, just as journalists exaggerate their own significance endlessly, one of the great risks of historians, or indeed any other group of academics, is they imagine that because they argue a case, necessarily they are influencing policy. And of course, intellectually, one knows that that doesn't really measure up to the volume of material that politicians have to engage with, nor to the relative attention that they give to particular constituencies of influence. And even if you can demonstrate that, for example, I suggested something to Graham on Monday, and he did the same thing on Wednesday, that doesn't prove that he did that thing on Wednesday because I suggested it on Monday. He might have already been resolved to do this. He, in fact, might have been delayed by being irritated by the fact that I was arguing for it, or even worried about the fact that I was arguing for it. So I think what I would fairly say is that Mackinder is much cited for the 1900s, but without there being any real sense that he was profoundly significant. Indeed, we can take that further. A clear geopolitical stance in that particular lecture to which we are referring is the idea of the challenge posed by Russia. Well, this is not new. This is scarcely a new challenge. And indeed, Britain had already fought Russia in the Crimean War and nearly gone to Russia on other occasions, most prominently the Otchakov crisis of 1791. Again, incidentally, part of what is now Ukraine, the 1877-1878 Eastern Crisis, the Penjdo crisis of 1885, and so on. So you don't need Mackinder to be aware that there is a potential problem with Russia, which has been made more spatially extensive, this problem, precisely because Russia is a power that stretches so widely. Now, we can leave aside prudential issues for a second. In other words, Mackinder was fascinated by the railway, but actually the ability of Russia to be an effective power in Pacific waters had been considerably lower than earlier anxieties had suggested. And indeed, Russia had sold up its Alaska commitment in 1867. And although there had been Russian expeditions into the Southern Pacific, and those who have been to Sydney will know there's a little fort there, which was built because of concerns about Russian warships possibly showing up in Sydney, and similar concerns in Melbourne. The practicality was that Russia's ability to project power in the Far East was less than might have been anticipated, given the size of its armed forces, given the fact that it did have naval bases there, and given the construction of the railway. And again, this shouldn't surprise us, because Russia was fundamentally westward facing. Most of its troops, its economic activities, if one wishes to think of geoeconomic factors, were in European Russia. So I think one has to be a bit cautious here. And on top of that, what previous crises showed, and indeed one could see that, for example, with British concerns about the idea of the Russians marching overland to India, which had been a concern, certainly with the position when Paul I was looking towards Napoleon in 1800-1801, these actual concerns were pretty impractical. The logistical lift wasn't there. And they also represented, as we talked about last time, a failure of distinguishing the scale of the map in terms of practicality from fiction or from fantasy. And I think that is a major problem. And lastly, it's worth bearing in mind that we talk about geopolitics as if it provides a clear answer. But of course, the British, fearful of Peter the Great moving westwards in 1716-17, nevertheless are paying Russian forces to move into Germany in 1735 and again in 1748 in order to deter possible French expansion. They are eager that Russia participates in the war of the Second Coalition against France, the war of the Third Coalition against France. They don't want Russia to settle with France, having defeated Napoleon in 1812. And although there are anxieties about Russian intentions in 1814 and 15, nevertheless, the Russian army is the basic guarantor against a French revanche, rather as the Russian army, or the Soviet army in some respects, was the basic guarantor against a comparable German situation after World War II, although that was a much more complex set of circumstances which we need to consider. So in other words, however you want to play the geopolitics, they are, as I've said, permissive It can be the case that if you take away that alarming language from Mackinder about a series of horse-riding peoples emerging from Asia, incidentally, as listeners will know, that's just straight out of Edward Gibbon. Edward Gibbon had, of course, referred to cannon and fortification forming an impregnable barrier against the Tartar horse. But, of course, the thing about Gibbon is he's providing Russia as the defence against barbarism, whereas for Mackinder, Russia is, as it were, the new barbarians, the new threat, the new challenge, the new threat to an Anglosphere, whether that Anglosphere is defined, as he is very interested in doing, in terms of empire, which he is very keen on, and or whether he wants to bring the United States in as well. And of course, with Mackinder, you've got actually both. So I think it's fair to say that with the 1904 discussion, and I'm going to take some comments now from Graham, with the 1904 discussion, what you have got is an interesting idea, there's no two ways about it, but you have not got a particularly helpful one. And indeed, if we are to go ahead and look at World War One, it didn't see the geopolitics anticipated by Mackinder. I mean, it's worth pointing out, Britain, in case one forgotten, allied with the heartland power, Russia, against another that was more on the periphery, Germany. Or looked at differently, because all of these become actually very flexible. Russia and Germany competed for control of the heartland, while at the same time, as Mackinder noticed, Germany also bid for naval success as an Atlantic power. And of course, you can take that a stage further by noting that I use the term, sort of Britain or Germany or Russia France. But of course, there were varieties. If you're looking at Germany, for example, particular German lobbies had their own goals. Tirpitz, the administrative head of the Navy and a bitter opponent of Britain, had proposed that Germany focus not only on the Navy, but also on the Western Front. And indeed, by November 1914, he was suggesting to the head of the German General Staff, the army, that Germany focus on the Western Front and pursue a separate peace with Russia on the basis of pre-war territorial boundaries. So not exactly somebody reading out from, we have to focus on control of the heartland. Now, we're going to take some discussion then. We will subsequently come to look on another occasion at Mackinder and the Ukraine after World War One. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. Mackinder is such an interesting figure, not least because he operates in different spheres as an academic, but also a politically minded one, and one who ultimately became a member of parliament. You talked a little bit about his interest in liberal unionism and the influence that had on his thinking, but he thought of himself as a geographer as well. I'm wondering where the balance is between Mackinder the theorist and Mackinder the man keen to see his policies in action.
Well, I think very good. I think both of those. I mean, as you say, he was a geographer. He'd been appointed reader in geography at Oxford in 1887. And remember, we're talking about a period when it's not like today, when sort of even the cleaner is called professor. These were periods in which a senior rank like reader or professor meant something. He then became, as well, principal of Oxford's Extension College at Reading in 1892. The very idea of an extension college, part of the notion of practical knowledge. He then becomes head at Oxford of Britain's first university geography department, 1899. That, again, is significant. He is developing a department and from new. And he then becomes second director of the London School of Economics in 1903. He resigns from Reading in 1903, but he combines his Oxford and his LSE commitments until 1905, when he focuses alone on the latter. So he's extraordinarily busy as an academic administrator. And again, different from today. Today, most administrators, most vice chancellors are people who may once have been interested in teaching and research. Not, they sort of give that up very rapidly. Very different in this period. But he also, as you say, he's interested in practical things, not just developing departments, developing the LSE, developing the Extension College, but also in 1907, he was responsible with Richard Haldane, the Secretary of State for War, one of the more interesting politicians of the period, and also a man of great intellectual eminence and clout. He institutes, the two of them, institute a class for the administrative training of army officers. So, in which, incidentally, one of the major subjects that crop up is logistics, which is a geographical one. And the key focus was on efficiency. And Mackinder was the major figure in getting the syllabus organised. Now, efficiency to its critics was a Germanophile idea. And Haldane, as you may know, was to be criticised as somebody who was pro-German, which I think is unfair. But what is interesting is that Mackinder was very happy in this course and more generally to see geography as part of a theatre of military operations and partly a concern with geostrategy. So if you look at the course, it has both an emphasis on India, but also the defence of Britain by means of command of the sea. It's worth bearing in mind that he fought, I mean, I mentioned he stood for Parliament. 1900, he fights in the so-called Khaki election during the Boer War. He fights it as a liberal imperialist. He fights Warwick, in fact. And as you will know, the liberals were the principal figures against the Boer War, the liberal unionists and the conservatives very much in favour of it. And this is an interesting election for Mackinder to decide that that is when he is going to put his toe in the water. He's persuaded by Leo Amery to join the Conservatives in 1903. And in 1908, Amery and Alfred Viscount Milner, a key figure, of course, in imperial expansion, notably Southern Africa, get the money. They organise the money to enable Mackinder to resign from the LSE and to focus on politics. So he fails in a by-election in 1909. He's successful in 1910. He gets elected in the first of the 1910 elections and re-elected in the second one. And he is re-elected again in 1918. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that he is a figure who is interested in politics as an MP. If you look at his parliamentary and other speeches, he deploys geopolitical arguments, for instance, on the future of Ireland. But the point I was making is that if you want to see him simply in terms of, you know, the geopolitical texts, you have to be aware that, as it were, the fluidity of that period scarcely lent itself to the rigidity of a schematic or systemic approach to international relations. And I would say that is a particular, and one of my interests, as you know, is international relations and strategy. And one of the problems is too many people want to have the clarity of a very systemic approach. And when you have multiple players in the field, including within your own country, let alone other people's countries, that is not really credible. It might be attractive, but it isn't credible.
Would you, in a a word which is much used these days, describe him as holistic in his approach? And also, how much of a student of history was he? Indeed, how relevant did he feel history was to an approach which is very forward-facing or future-facing?
Well, I think he was not a profound historical figure. He's not as interested in history as Alfred Thayer Mahan, who, of course, as you will know, is writing in the United States in the 1890s, 1900s, nor as Julian Corbett, who's writing in Britain. And I don't think it's any accident that both of those men are more profound. I mean, geopolitics has always struck me as being, if you like, if I could use the term, history light, because it lacks, on the whole, an engagement with as I've already indicated, the multivalent character of the historical process and the way in which it isn't moving in a predictable direction. And of course, for those listeners who are interested in these ideas, there was an attempt to, as it were, bridge the gap from the 1970s onwards with the notion of strategic culture, which we'll be talking about in a subsequent discussion. But that doesn't work either, because it again suggests a kind of constancy, which is not particularly helpful. So I think what one has to do is say, yes, geographical factors are pertinent, they are important, but they do not determine. And I think actually Mackinder's lecture must have been very exciting to hear, with all these flourishes of Heartland, Pivot and all the rest of it. But actually, if you drilled down to it, its history was rather poor. Its prognosis was inaccurate, and it didn't really engage with the specific problems facing Britain at that moment. 0 out of 10. But of course, nobody was going to say to the director of the LSE, oh, well, I don't think that's very good, sir.
Yes, I'm sure. Would you say...
I mean, actually, I was told a very funny story by Steve Smith, who had been... in international relations at Aberystwyth. And he told me a story that when Kenneth Morgan, the sort of well-connected Oxford historian and sort of member of the Taffia, turned up at Aber as principal, vice-chancellor in effect, he demanded that some librarian be produced to him, and he berated this librarian because he dared to criticise Morgan in a book review. But the point about that story is that, you know, vice chancellors do not tend to be surrounded by people saying, well, you know, I don't think that's very good. And however they opine, it tends to be published, and it tends to be published in a eulogistic fashion. I actually don't think Mackinder's 1904 lecture is particularly profound. I think it's fascinating the attention it's received, and it is important to look at it, because all too much when we consider political thought, I mean, I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, I did the political thought, one of the two political thought papers, and it was essentially all about ethics and obedience, consent within an individual polity. What it really was very weak on was international relations and those kind of elements within. And I would say that's still the case with political thought as a subject in Britain and indeed the United States. And I think it actually is something we suffer from. I think we also suffer in terms of our public debate from a degree of simplicity and simplification in the way and the conceptualization we use and employ when we're trying to discuss the current situation and therefore the situation in the future. And, you know, you can see endless books trot out with their, you know, banal accounts of some easy idea which apparently explains the European question. So, I mean, there was a particularly stupid one from Brendan Sims a few years ago. And you've just got to think to yourself, well, do these people not realise that the players do not consider themselves subordinate to a system that is telling them how to proceed? I mean, we've just had the G20 summit. It wasn't as though people took some lecture from some political theorists at the outcome, telling them what the answer was, and they all said, right, sir, how quickly can we sign up to that?
Mm-hmm. What do we know if any of the politicians of the period were at the 1904 lecture, or have we seen any correspondence which suggests they heard about it soon after in discussions and pondered what it meant? Or really, the Mackinder influence is something that suffuses over a long period of time, and whether or not it influences politicians, it's almost at a level which is difficult to make tangible.
Well, now then, you've got an interesting one then. There were obviously some interesting people there. Spencer Wilkinson, for example, was there. Leo Amery was there. But no, if you're asking me, did Balfour sit up and say, right, when I become Prime Minister, this is what I need to do? No, the answer is no, of course not. And I think that I would be very wary at that term suffused. I mean, what I would argue, and we're going to sort of come to this, I suppose, is that Mackinder's great influence occurs almost, you might say, when he's dead, which is, of course, when most of us are going to be influential, if we are. And that is that some of his ideas are absorbed by Americans thinking about containment. And the notion of containment, which is a sort of way in which they read, in my view, not terribly sensibly from what Mackinder was saying, although bear in mind, Mackinder does say different things at different stages of his life, as we will discuss, that then, as it were, plays through into their argument that Mackinder has discerned a Manichaean struggle in international relations, the world question, as it were, and, you know, that Britain sort of sought to pursue that first against Imperial Germany, then against the communists, then against Nazi Germany, and has become weak and succumbed, and now it's the Americans' turn. Well, as I hope to discuss, that's again a dangerous simplification, but I think that is, if you wanted to trace out the argument, that's where it ought to be traced.
Well, we will discuss these matters in subsequent episodes, but for now, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.